From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is Which Way LA.
Will medicating the mentally ill increase public safety? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Not all of America's recent shootings have been blamed on the mentally ill, but they have raised suspicions. LA County supervisors want the state to expand what's called Laura's Law, designed to head off trouble by forcibly medicating people who might commit violent crimes. Statistics show the mentally ill are not more violent than anyone else. Does Laura's Law make things better or worse? Also tonight, mixed verdicts in the trial of former council members in the city of Bell and the state of Washington's new advisor on legalizing marijuana. Later on, to the point, will Cyprus be the mouse that roared in the Eurozone? First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
We're on back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Financial trouble in tiny Cyprus is the latest threat to the entire Eurozone. With their banks in danger, should ordinary Cypriots be taxed to protect wealthy Russians? Would that precedent lead to a run on banks with problems in other countries? We'll entangle those and other questions later on To the Point. First, this story. A jury today found five former Bell City Council members guilty of misappropriating public funds by accepting pay for meetings of the Solid Waste and Recycling Authority. Prosecutors argued that it was established for the sole purpose of increasing their salaries. All five were acquitted on similar charges related to the Public Finance Authority. A sixth defendant, Pastor Luis Artiga, was acquitted on all counts. Ali Saleh was elected mayor in the aftermath of the Bell corruption scandal. Mr. Mayor, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
What do you think of these verdicts?
Well, today's guilty ruling for the five of the Bell six brings some closure and justice to our community. There are still trials which remain pending, and those trials will remain the assailants that, in my view, plundered our city resources and shackles Bell hardworking families.
And whose trial are you most concerned about, most interested in now?
Robert Rizzo.
And Robert Rizzo was the city manager who set up these boards. Is that right?
That's correct.
So what about the fact that they were acquitted with regard to one board but not the other? What sort of distinctions do you think the jury was making?
I think it was just the evidence that was presented to them by the DA, and I feel that they kind of circled down to those specific boards and what they were looking at. I don't have that affects what they were basically looking at, but I feel, so there's some sort of closure and justice to our community, but it would have been nice that if they would have found them guilty of all charges. But again, we left it in the hands of the court system and the jury.
What about the total acquittal of Pastor Artiga? He was not on the council when those boards were created, and I guess his defense was arguing that he didn't really understand the whole situation.
Well, he came in towards the end, was appointed by the previous administration. Exactly what the jury had said was not part of the decision-making when they did put those boards together, and they found him not guilty, and I guess he's walked away.
Ali Saleh, once again, elected mayor in the aftermath of what's now referred to as the Bell corruption scandal. Christina Garcia represents District 58 in the state assembly. It does not include Bell, but she is a member of BASTA. That's the Bell Association to Stop the Abuse. Ms. Garcia, good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
What's your reaction?
I think there's mixed emotions. I think after 2.5 years, it's, validating to finally have some guilty verdicts. But I think at the end of the day, as we're healing and moving forward, I think it shouldn't be lost on the public that this still is still a community that has to carry the burden of all that money that was misappropriated and the responsibility of turning that government around.
So how much money are we talking about here?
About $150 million.
That's a lot of money for a town the size of Bell. What's the budget of the city?
Under $14 million a year.
So we're talking about big money in a small town. Is there any way to get that money back?
Well, I think there's definitely going to be some restitution that the judge, you know, here in this criminal case could bring forth, but also the civil lawsuits. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm not sure what's going to come back, but the reality is that the city of Bell has some of the highest taxes for the whole county in L.A. due to this bond money that has been misappropriated.
What are you expecting in terms of the trial of the former city manager who is accused of having set this whole system up?
You know, I hope we have more guilty verdicts than we had here. And I hope the jury moving forward, you know, for this for the next case, and even the jury that has been asked to go back and deliberate a little further on some of these charges, realizes that these individuals were once ordinary citizens, but when they took that oath of office, by choice, they became extraordinary citizens. And they took on a higher morale and a legal responsibility to do right by the people of Bell.
You're now in the state assembly. There's no chance of the state helping out the city of Bell in this case, is there?
You know, I'm one of 121 folks here that makes decisions, and so on a regular basis, I do advocate for the city of Bell and just for good government and the working class in general, but it'd have to be something amongst all of our peers. The city, you know, has issues, and the state is also coming out of a crisis, so I can't make decisions on my own here.
Sure. Let me go back to the mayor of the city of Bell, the current mayor of the city of Bell, Ali Saleh. What do you do differently now in the city of Bell from the way business was conducted when Mr. Rizzo was in charge?
Well, when we were elected, it was the path we were looking at is bringing in good governance to City Hall and transparency. So that's been our main focus, is bringing good governance and transparency, as you see on our website, which we currently have that just launched the beginning of this year. You see all the vendors' contract. You see every single employee here in the city, their name, title, and salary, plus every check warrant, every check that is written by the city is on our website. So we're trying to gain that trust of the community. As it is, it's hard for any normal citizens to have trust in any government. So that's our position of how we're trying to gain that trust. And like tomorrow, we have a community forum where we bring in every director that kind of discusses everything that's happening in the city and get some feedback from the residents.
Do you even have paychecks on the website?
Yes, we do.
What's the city doing? Does it still have a budget of $14 million, having lost $150
million? Actually, those $150 million are bonds that were taken out by the previous administration, but if the budget is $14 million, we balanced our previous budget, and we're looking forward to balancing this year's budget also.
So at the moment, then, you don't have to cut back on services?
At the moment, we're giving the community services, and we're trying to do as much as possible and continue to serve the community of Bell.
Okay. More to come, obviously, in court, particularly when the former city manager, Mr. Rizzo, goes on trial. In the meantime, thanks to you both, the Mayor Ali Saleh and Assemblywoman Christina Garcia. Good to have you both on our program.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
Subscribe to the Which Way L.A. podcast at kcrw.com/WhichWayLA or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find Which Way L.A. on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. The raft of multiple shootings around the country has L.A. County supervisors asking the legislature to expand what's called Laura's Law. It's named for a woman who worked at a mental health clinic in Nevada County and who was killed by a patient. The purpose of Laura's Law is to medicate mentally ill people who have been refusing treatment before they commit any crime. The legislature has not provided any funding, and so far only Nevada County has fully implemented Laura's Law. But L.A. County does have a pilot program. Mary Marks runs it for the Department of Mental Health. Good to have you, Mary Marks, on our program.
Thank you for having me.
There's a major change, or a difference, as I understand it, between your pilot program and Laura's Law in that yours is voluntary.
Correct. Our Board of Supervisors approved us to implement Laura's Law with the provision that it be a voluntary program.
So tell us about it. What does it do?
Well, basically, the program is available for individuals from a variety of settings, and it provides housing and integrated health, mental health, and substance abuse treatment services, as well as helping people to get benefits and move to lower levels of care. So it's very intensive mental health services.
What about those people who have resisted mental health treatment?
Well, we make this program available to that population through our county hospitals and people who are in our jails, And we do aggressive outreach and engagement to get them into the program. We also let them know that those services are available to them if they choose not to participate in the program, and we help to link them otherwise. But presently, what they do is they reach a settlement agreement with the court and participate in the program for 6 months.
Okay. Again, Mary Marks is with the Los Angeles County Department of Mental Health. Philip Chen is health deputy for Supervisor Mike Antonovich. Good to have you on our program.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. Thank you. Now, it's my understanding that your supervisor wants, in fact, to implement the involuntary treatment of mentally ill people. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. In fact, Supervisor Antonovich was a supervisor that brought Laura's Law implemented here in Los Angeles County. You know, he believes that the homeless issue is intricately intertwined with mental health and drug and substance abuse. So we modeled Laura's Law with many of the facts and figures from Kendra's Law in New York, and we've seen that there's 74% fewer people that experience homelessness, 77% fewer people experience psychiatric hospitalization, and 83% fewer people experience arrest. We know that there's people that are living out on the street right now, and just because that you're able to live on the street, find food and shelter from a trash can, or live on the street, it doesn't mean that you're leading a life of productivity. So he wants to make sure that the services are there for them to lead a life of productivity and get the life that they deserve.
How do you involuntarily treat them? How do you treat them if they don't want to be treated?
That's a good point. One of the things that we're looking at is to make sure that there's a panel review board that are experts in mental health to make sure that they implement the programs that they need. One of the major issues with Laura's Law are, one, the lack of state funding. Because, as Mary said, these are very intensive programs. So there is no funding or dedicated funds to implement Laura's Law. And two, there's restriction of voluntary funds. So right now, for example, like Prop 63, the Mental Health Service Act dollars cannot be used for Laura's Law. And currently there's a bipartisan effort from Democrats and Republicans to implement Laura's Law on a larger scale. And that means funding.
Again, Philip Chen is health deputy for Supervisor Mike Antonovich. Rusty Selix is executive director and legislative representative for the Mental Health Association in California. Mr. Selix, good to have you on our show.
Good afternoon. Happy to be with you.
What's your experience with mental health, and what's your attitude toward the involuntary medication of mentally ill people?
Well, first of all, I've been an advocate for mental health in the state capitol for more than 20 years, and was involved in the discussions that led to Laura's Law. And I've never been across a law that had so many misconceptions as this one. This law is a last resort law. It applies to a very narrow range of people. Now, Mr. Antonovich's aide is correct in saying that the homeless is a high priority population. Fact is, when we started the voluntary type programs, all the people who were pushing for involuntary said the homeless don't want to be helped. You won't get to them. Well, the fact is, when we started those programs, over 90% came in voluntarily. It's a very rare individual that's that severely disabled that, when offered the intensive services that Ms. Marks was describing, actually refuses those services. And then to find even among those who refuse, those that meet the criteria of Laura's Law, of the past history and all that, is even smaller number. So this is a very minor issue that is really hyped by people both for it and people against it, that it does not result in forced medication. That is not part of what Laura's Law allows. It's a very gentle program where, as a practical matter, the services that will be provided will be voluntary. The person could be ordered to participate in the program, but then all the services have to be voluntary. As a practical matter, there has never been a program anywhere where someone can really recover from these severe and disabling mental illnesses without that person's active, willing participation, because eventually they have to be able to take their medication on their own and manage their condition, and that just can't be done on an involuntary basis. The involuntary is a whole different issue. There is a large number of people who have mental illnesses and are not treated for it and do not believe they need to be treated. That's who people think Laura's Law is for, but as a practical matter, it's not for very many of them. Almost all of those people are stable, and what's happened is that the problem in their case is their mental illness was neglected for a really long time, and they've gotten used to their life with their mental illness. It's a much more limiting life, and it's very frustrating to their family and friends and people who want them to get treatment that they know they need. But because we didn't catch it early, they've kind of accepted who they are. So the solution that we advocate for is to expand opportunities in primary care and at schools to catch mental illnesses early in their onset, before people become homeless, before they need the expensive intensive care. That's what we think will help far more people and steer far more people away from the path where they could potentially become disabled and where they could become, you know, dangerous to themselves or others. We think that's the far better approach. It's not that Laura's Law is necessarily bad. I could argue both sides of it. It's that it's for a very, very, very narrow class of people and a real last resort. And the fact is that, as was mentioned by the other speakers, there's a shortage of funds, and counties have far more people that need that level of intensive services than they have available funds. And they just never get to the place of debating why this person here that's not wanting these services, that very rare individual, is serving them so much more important that we're going to go through the extra time, effort, and cost to use Laura's Law to serve them and displace somebody else who wants to be treated and who, frankly, to the county, looks just as, risky and has just as many problems as the other.
Okay, Rusty Selleck again is with the Mental Health Association in California, both the executive director and the legislative representative. Back to Philip Chen with Mike Antonovich's office. Is that the way you understand things, that really only a very small number of those that are in fact mentally ill would be involuntarily treated or ordered to participate, I guess, is the best way to put it. You don't grab them by the arm and stick a needle in them.
Well, we certainly aren't looking to grabbing them in the arm and stick a needle in them, but as it stands right now, we do have those programs. We do have those programs in which have prevention and early intervention. We have EPSDT, and they're funded by Prop 63, the Millionaires Tax and Health Service Act dollars, if you will. They have a dedicated source of funding. So we have those outreach programs that start early on to prevent a person to have episodic psychotic episodes. However, when we have our outreach teams go out to Skid Row, we have outreach teams that go out to certain pockets here in LA County that has a large contingent of homeless population. Our numbers state that at least 20% refuse services. And time again, we've seen examples in which we have family members who refuse services, and because they refuse services, they lead down to a further scope of mental illness.
How do you know they're mentally ill when they're refusing services?
Usually when it comes to that point, it gets to a point where they're a danger to themselves and others. They hurt themselves, they hurt others. A case in point is I know another individual who is an executive board member for NAMI, which is one of the largest mental health advocacy groups here in the state of California. And her son, is an adult, and she has no type of legal authority over him. And he's been in and out of jail. So in and out of jails, hurting himself, hurting other people's, racking up that, unfortunately, that the crime rate, if you will, and looking at, ways for him to get help has been very difficult. In fact, when he can go to jail, he's not receiving the proper treatment. That right now, LA County jail system is the largest mental health provider. Over 30% of the people in it have mental health issues. So when that person leaves or is released from jail, there has to be some type of way in which we can give them the treatment and the programs in order for them to lead a life of productivity.
But let me go back to Mary Marks. It's my understanding that if somebody is, as Philip Chen just said, dangerous to him or herself or others, then you can already put them into a facility against their will. Isn't that right?
That's correct. We have the Lanternman Petra Short Act. When someone meets the criteria for those behaviors, we can hospitalize them for a number of days to stabilize them.
So, Philip Chen, if that's the case, why do you need this increase in money for Laura's Law if it involves such a small number of all of those that you've described?
I think that number is actually relatively large, but also we can only involuntary mental health treat them for a specific number of days. If you talk to Mary Marsh about it, it ranges from 14 days to a couple of weeks, but it's only a limited amount of time that we can treat them. And again, these type of services are extremely intensive, extremely intensive. They have to be wraparound. They have to be 24 hours a day, and there is no dedicated source of funding for them.
Okay, Rusty Seelix, back to you. What's the impact on somebody who doesn't want treatment, who is, in fact, mentally ill, and who is forced to have a treatment? Does that work?
Well, you know, the reality is that if you have one chance to treat somebody and try one dose of medication, you've got about a 20% chance of coming up with the perfect drug and the perfect dose that's going to produce a really good result. If you have a willing cooperative client and you can work with them over a period of months, you've got an 80 to 90% chance of coming up with the medication or combination of medications that are really going to work. That's why there's such a strong backlash against any form of forced medication from people who've been subjected to it in the past, because they've generally had very negative experiences with it, and it makes them more treatment resistant than they might have been if we had really gone all out and used all possible means to get people to come in voluntarily. And so that's why this type of law should be a last resort. Clearly, there are people for whom the risk of doing, you know, bad things to themselves or others is sufficiently great that you're willing to take that risk. But it's a very small number of people.
Okay, so we're just about out of time. Philip Chen, do you expect that the legislature will respond, will provide money for the enhanced use of Laura's Law?
Right now is the golden time. The golden time is because right now there's five bills, a bipartisan effort for both Republicans and Democrats. You know, Connie Conway, the minority leader for the Assembly, is introducing a bill. Senator Leland Yee, a Democrat, is also introducing a bill. Daryl Steinberg, the leader of the minority, the majority party, is also introducing a bill.
But there's famously no money. Where's the money going to come from? How much is it going to be?
That's a very good question. So one of the bills talks about utilizing Prop 63 dollars, Mental Health Service Act dollars, to be able to fund Laura's Law programs. The other thing
is... And you don't think that would take money away from other programs, which Mr. Seelix says would be more effective?
You know, I think that Laura's Law programs are essential, and I think Laura's Law programs are a program in which we can't wait for the person to hurt themselves or hurt them others repeatedly.
But you already have the capacity to 5150 them if, in fact, they are dangerous to themselves or others.
On a very limited basis. And again, these programs are very intensive.
Would they be required then to go in indefinitely?
No, not at all. You know, there is no indefinite amount of time in which they have to go through that. You know, right now we're looking at finding the source of funding for it. And as it currently stands, all voluntary programs, if there is even a revenue source for the funding programs or an extra budget for them, they cannot be used to fund any type of Laura's Law program. So what we're asking is that for Laura's Law programs, that they have the funding capacity and the funding stream available to them to be able to have the programs necessary to treat the 20% that we see on the street that are repeatedly hurting themselves and, again, hurting other people.
Okay. And Rusty Seelix, you think this will have unintended consequences. Let's put it that way.
Again, I think if it's applied in a very limited manner to a very small number of people, for that rare individual for you say the risk of their case is sufficiently great that it outweighs the needs of all others who seem to be similar, then I don't know that it's all that harmful. But if you try to apply it broadly and you don't use the kind of treat it as a last resort and you don't emphasize all the voluntary approaches as the primary approach, and then there's a risk. As long as it's not displacing funding for all the other things, and as long as it's used as a last resort for that very narrow group of people, I don't think it's harmful,
okay.
But that's a very rare individual.
All right. Obviously, there is a controversy about this, about how many people we're talking about, what the resources will require, and we'll see what happens as the legislature does its work. Hopefully, all of you can join us again. Rusty Seelix again with the Mental Health Association in California, Mary Marks at the Los Angeles County Department of Mental Health, and Philip Chen, Health Deputy for Supervisor Mike Antonovich. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with Which Way LA.
You're listening to Which Way LA from KCRW. Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/whichwayla or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter @WWLA.
We're on only back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way L.A. Voters in Colorado and Washington states have agreed to legalize marijuana, but nobody knows what the impact will be. That's according to UCLA professor Mark Kleiman, whose company Botec Analysis has been hired to consult on the implementation in Washington and determine what works and what doesn't. Professor, good to have you on our program.
A great pleasure.
Tell us why it is nobody knows what works.
There is nowhere in the world today a legal system for producing, distributing, and selling marijuana for other than recreational purposes.
So it's not like alcohol, not like cigarettes, any place in the world.
Well, right. There's no place in the world where those are the rules for marijuana. People think that the Netherlands legalized. In fact, they decided not to enforce against retail sales. But growing is still a crime you can go to prison for. So as the Dutch say, the front door of the coffee shop where the customers come in is legal or almost legal. The back door is strictly illegal. And as a result, Dutch coffee shops sell pot for about the same prices that street dealers do.
So what then are the options available to the state of Washington under the law passed by the voters?
The board has to decide how many growers to license, how many processors to license, and how many retailers to license. They have to decide what testing is required. They have to decide what goes on the package label, which is complicated. I mean, marijuana is a much more complicated drug than alcohol, right? If you drink beer, there's only one psychoactive agent in it, and that's alcohol. If you smoke marijuana, there's 60 chemicals in the smoke that are unique to the cannabis plant. At least two of them are importantly psychoactive. And so the consumers presumably ought to know at least that much. Maybe they ought to know more. One of the things we don't know about is the way the consumers would react to having that information available. And so the board's going to have to make some decisions quickly because they've got a deadline in the law of having regulations in place December 1st. But whatever they do December 1st, they're going to want to change a year later. And the best set of regulations, in my view, is the one that's easiest to adapt to new information.
So it would seem to me that there are two possibilities here. One would be that you have a few large dealers, like you do with beer, which you mentioned earlier, or manufacturers, I should say, and they're easy to find and you can tax them and operate in an orderly manner. Or you have a system where lots and lots of people get to manufacture marijuana. Is that right?
It's either like mass market beer or it's like craft beer. Or it's some compromise.
Okay. What do you think would be the most effective?
Two levels of answer to that question. One, don't know because we haven't done the analysis yet. And two, we're not being hired to tell the board what to do. Right? The decisions here are going to be made by the people chosen by the governor. We've been hired to tell them what the likely consequences are of doing one thing rather than another. So, for example, if you have many producers, you probably have more product variety. On the other hand, you may have less quality control. The enforcement's going to be harder because you've got more people to inspect. And on the other hand, if you have a small number of producers, you have to worry about, one, whether that's going to attract federal enforcement, and two, whether you're going to have a highly concentrated industry that drives small business out and may have a lot of lobbying muscle with the state legislature.
What about the black market? What about a black market?
Well, so there's three different kinds of black market risk. One is that if the price is higher than the current illicit price, people will continue to buy from illegal dealers rather than from legal stores. On the other hand, if the price is lower than the current illegal price, then people may export marijuana from Washington to neighboring states. The third issue, of course, is availability to kids, which is strictly illegal now and will be under the new law. But there's clearly going to be some leakage. And in deciding on regulations, which in turn will help shape the price, the board has to consider whether they can get to a Goldilocks point that's not too high, not too low, but just right. And that's going to be tricky, particularly because whatever they do at the beginning, you should expect prices to fall rapidly over the first 2 years as people learn how to do this business.
You mentioned that, of course, this is still illegal under federal law. What do you intend to advise the state of Washington about that? The voters there have said it's going to be legal in that state, but how do they get around that? How do they avoid having the federal government come in and enforce its laws, whatever they do?
My understanding is that there are discussions now going on involving the Justice Department and the governors in the two states that have legalized. And I don't know anything about what those discussions are. But one thing that Washington should be prepared to do is to say, here's our plan for making sure that what starts in Washington stays in Washington. I mean, the federal government's primary concern ought to be interstate commerce. And if Washington can demonstrate that that's not going to be a major issue or no more of an issue than it is today, that should be a good reason for the federal government to let them run this experiment. But we're still waiting.
What have we learned from the legalization of medical marijuana in California? Are there any models that have been found that would be applicable anyplace else and might be useful?
I think the legalization of medical marijuana in California has had mostly bad lessons to teach us, in particular the corruption of the medical process. So I'm not sure there's anything that Washington wants to learn from California, but I could be wrong about that. Bo Kilmer at RAND, who's one of the team leaders on this project, has done a lot of work on the California medical market. And so whatever insights are available, we'll try to integrate.
We've talked about a lot of problems. Are there any upsides to legalizing marijuana?
Well, nationally, certainly, there would be upsides. I mean, there's about a $30 billion illicit market, I'm now told. That's $30 billion in money that's going to criminals. But doesn't have to, and that's that revenue is generated entirely by the law, right? Criminals don't get any money out of the alcohol business. There are 800,000 arrests a year for marijuana possession. There are about 40,000 people behind bars for marijuana dealing. Consumers are buying material of unknown potency, not tested. The illicit market has been trending toward more and more dangerous forms of the drug. And so one benefit of legalization is that lots of people who like to smoke a little bit of pot from time to time can pursue their habit legally and safely.
Okay, there's a lot of issues involved. What's your deadline?
Well, the first deadline is that they have to get regs on the street December 1st. So we're going to be, all of us are going to be scrambling
okay.
to help with that process.
All right.
There's a multi-year period after that of watching and adjusting.
Okay, Mark Kleiman, professor of public policy at UCLA, co-author of Drugs and Drug Policy, What Everyone Needs to Know, and Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. Good to have
Warren,
you on our program, and good luck.
Thanks.
Remember, you can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, we'll talk about the situation in Cyprus. Will that country be the mouse that roared in the Eurozone on To the Point?